Hi, everybody. I'd like to get started. Welcome to Random Review. My name is Deborah Goldenberg, and along with Connie Georgiou, who is off gallivanting on the East Coast somewhere today, the two of us coordinate the Random Review program for the Friends of the Library. This is our 20th year. I'd like to give a word of thanks to our generous sponsors. Northwest Graphic Imaging makes our posters free of charge. Trader Joe's provides our flowers. And our newest sponsor is Grassroots Books and Music, downtown on 2nd Street. And they provide books for our reviewers to use if they so desire. Very nice thing. Also, thanks to the second floor librarians who provide us with a cart of books, topical books for each review that are available for checkout. So feel free to look through those. I'd like to tell you about our beautiful new poster display board in the foyer. It's on the right-hand side on the wall as you come into the library. This was built in honor of the Friends of the Library's 50th anniversary by two members of the Mid-Willamette Valley Woodworkers Guild, Pat McGowan and Eric Brunswald. Pat did the design and the construction, and Eric did the finishing, which was all donated work, and it just turned out lovely. The acrylic poster sleeves were constructed and donated in part by High Tech Plastics, and the black walnut was donated by Lewis Judy from Northwest Timber in Jefferson. I'd like to thank all who were involved in creating this lovely fixture, which I hope will be in use for many years. Next month's review will be on November 14th, and it will be a review of the book Packing the Court, The Rise of Judicial Power and the Coming Crisis of the Supreme Court by James McGregor Burns. I should have said that with a Scottish accent. And it will be reviewed by Judge Robert Gardner. And you probably noticed that we've got two political books in a row here. I think we're getting them out of the way so that after November, we'll all be free of politics. Ha-ha. The bookmarks with our schedule on them have been printed, and they are on the back table, so please help yourself to one of those. They're nice to have. And I think that's all I need to say. I would like to invite Judy Lee, one of our Random Review Committee members, to introduce today's speaker.
So, as you can tell from the very first slide there, John Dentler, who's our speaker, has been our friend for many years, since the mid-1970s. When he was an undergraduate in fisheries, and my husband Hiram was on the faculty there. Even then, he expressed an interest in natural resource in combination with management and social science, particularly economics, and that's a theme of his career. He finished his master's at UC Davis and came up here, spent a bit of time on the OSU campus, and then became a fisheries biologist for the Oregon Department of Fisheries and Wildlife over at their research lab. He and Maureen were married under a wonderful oak tree out at Tyee Winery, and then they took off and went to Washington, D.C., where he became the fisheries staff advisor for the Natural Resources Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives, where he advised not only members of Congress, but international delegations that were negotiating Pacific salmon and Atlantic salmon treaties. That gave him the kind of experience I can imagine useful for his next position, which was in Southern California, where he was chief for the trade and industry section of the Southwest region of the North, the National Marine Science Fisheries Science Service, excuse me. And there it became much more international, where he was working with Western Pacific fisheries. Given all this experience with legislation and policy and resource, he decided to go to law school, where at the University of Puget Sound, he got a law degree, and he became an environmental lawyer for several years, both in a large firm and then in his own firm. But in recent years, he has used that experience to work in a international aquaculture program, starting with a program in Chile, and then moving into positions of greater responsibility as director and partner, and is based out of Tacoma. So today, he drove down from Gig Harbor to tell us a little bit of his experience and review the book for us, which in part relate to the experiences he had in Washington, D.C., but you can see from his resume, there's a lot of other information that he brings to this conversation. It is my pleasure to introduce my dear friend, John Dentler.
Thank you, Judy and Hiram, and thank you for inviting me. If you can't hear me well enough, just give a shout, raise your hand, let me know. If you have a burning question that you want to ask during the presentation, please feel free to raise your hand and let me know.
Let's do this.
Better? Is that okay? Can you hear me? Everyone can hear me. Okay. So anyway, if you do have a burning question or even a comment you would like to make, please raise your hand. This is, as far as I'm concerned, very informal. So with that, let's sort of get underway. Well, obviously, I have a long connection with Hiram and Judy and a connection here in Corvallis. And it's a pleasure always to come back here. It feels very comfortable. I know right where the bakery is, and which I frequented this morning. It's nice to have people pop in and say hello. Wayne Burke, who I used to work with, is here in the audience. So it feels very comfortable. I lived here from 79 to 82. Ended up working, as Judy said, for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. My wife worked for the Retired Senior Volunteer Program. And she had decided she wanted to go to medical school and was accepted at two places, Chicago and Washington, D.C. And it didn't take very long for us to decide, of those two cities, where were we going to go? So basically, we decided to move to D.C. And I, of course, wanted to work for the U.S. Congress, and in particular, with a committee that had jurisdiction over natural resource issues. And as you can see, how naive was I? Very naive. I had no political experience whatsoever. I had no knowledge of Washington, D.C., had never been to the city before, didn't know a soul there. So it was a bit of a mystery as to how to get started. So I brought a bunch of resumes with me, a lot of enthusiasm, and one wool suit. Well, anyone that's been to D.C. in August knows that a wool suit in D.C. is not a good mix. But I was very persistent and very lucky and ended up in the right place at the right time. Basically, the networking worked. I ended up in an office with a young woman that worked for Joel Pritchard, who is from Washington State. And by then, I had made many rounds throughout the Hill and was starting to, this network, I was starting to get the same names over and over. And she told me, well, boy, there's nothing that she could think of. And at the last minute, she said, oh, you should go down the hall and talk to this woman who's the head of fish and wildlife issues for the House Committee on Marine Fisheries. So I did, and we had kind of an impromptu interview, and I think I probably said the right thing to her, which was, she asked, well, what brought you to Washington, D.C.? And I said, well, my wife's decided to go to medical school, and I'm going to support her while, you know, she goes to school, and I really want to work on the Hill. Well, she was a trailblazer. She had started as a secretary in the FBI, the very same building we were working in, and she had struggled professionally all of her life to try to get to the next rung. So I think I had played into her sympathies by saying, well, I was making this sacrifice to help put my wife through medical school. And it does have some relevance. I mean, her experience has relevance to some of what Ira Shapiro has to say in his book. There's a couple of interesting passages in around page 56 where he talks about Joe Biden, of all people, doesn't want to hire Paula Stern because he's afraid of what people might think if he has to travel with her. What was he thinking about? Mr. Byrd, the majority leader, didn't want women in the cloakroom, even though they were professional staffers. How are they going to get their work done if they can't even go and talk to the members? So, you know, there's been a lot of change that has taken place from the time that my boss, Jackie Westcott, worked on Capitol Hill. And you can see that Ira Shapiro is sort of talking about how that old boys club is changing during the time that he's there. So anyway, I, as Judy said, I worked for the House, it's actually the House Committee on Merchant Marine and Fisheries. And the chairman was from North Carolina. And the ranking minority member was from New Jersey. And so my sort of scope of coverage was fisheries issues. And as Judy said, it really ran the gamut from drafting legislation, amendments, briefing documents, going to meetings, international meetings at times. In fact, I was talking to John Byrne. We had run into one another at one point in Rome at an FAO meeting, I think. That's been quite a few years ago. But anyway, it was a fantastic job for me. So basically this book, The Last Great Senate, sort of picks up or ends right where I pick up on Capitol Hill. And so I'm sort of seeing the aftermath of what Shapiro is talking about. And basically the book, you know, ends in a rather devastating note for most moderate Democrats and, in fact, many moderate Republicans. And there's a big sea change in politics at that time. So when I ended up on Capitol Hill, Reagan was in the White House, so Carter had lost. The Senate had gone Republican, so Howard Baker had gone from minority leader to majority leader. On the House side where I worked, Tip O'Neill was the speaker. And it was a largely kind of a defensive period from my perspective, legislatively, because there really wasn't, with some exception, and I'll try to talk about that later, there really wasn't room for grandiose new programs. It was basically a time that, from my perspective, I felt like I was trying to protect the budgets of the Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service. And it was a time when tax cuts were taking place. The administration wanted to make spending cuts, and I'm sure John Byrne could probably attest to the fact that he was probably under pressure to, you know, cut various programs at NOAA. And that's just the way it works. But from part of my job was to talk to constituents, talk to members, and start to defend that budget through the appropriations process. So that's kind of what I was doing. Well, I think there's a lot to recommend this book. Well, for one, obviously Ira Shapiro is an insider. You know, he has great, yeah.
Get closer.
Sure, okay, thanks. Thank you. He's an insider. He has great institutional knowledge. He has some really good descriptions on key events and key senators. And I think just a couple of the chapters, he has one chapter called The Grind that is really about Robert Byrd. And actually, I had forgotten some things about Robert Byrd that were kind of fun to, oops. Let's see if I can get this going again. Oops, I see what's happened. Bear with me. Mm-hmm. So anyway, he talks about Robert Burden, the fact that, you know, he's orphaned at a very early age, brings himself pretty much up by his bootstraps. But he also points out that he's a racist. You know, he belongs to the KKK. He opposes the Civil Rights Act while he's in the Senate. But he evolves. He works at, I think he's one of these people that when I saw him on Capitol Hill, he was remarkable for being studious. It always appeared that he was poring over something. And that's why I think he calls it the grind. But I think it was very interesting that Robert Byrd had this racist background and evolved and overcame it and eventually became the majority leader. And that's, as far as I'm concerned, that's a very remarkable thing that the Senate would make him majority leader. And I think it's a testament to just how hard he worked. In some respects, I think Ira Shapiro is he's obviously comes from a Democratic side, and he's a little biased. And I think one thing that he misses, for example, he talks glowingly of Byrd, as he should, but he kind of skips over this racist aspect of Robert Byrd. On the other hand, you know, he talks at times about how the Senate denied confirmation of a couple of Supreme Court justices because they had a racist background. It's just kind of an interesting observation that I have. I'll pass on to that. The other person that I think he portrays fairly well is Howard Baker. And I do have a little bit of inside knowledge of Howard Baker, and I'll try to turn to that a little bit later. But here's this guy who's very relaxed. He comes to the Hill as a lawyer. He marries into a political family. He is really the consummate natural politician. He's handsome, articulate, breaks his teeth on the Watergate hearings. And he's that guy that said, in terms of the Watergate hearing, what was it? What did the president know and when did he know it? It's like, we can all remember that. I think Shapiro also does a really great job of research. If you look at the bibliography in this book, it's enormous. It, for a historian, I think it probably has a couple of demerits. One is it's not footnoted. So, you know, you can't really tell exactly what source he's using. But if you look in the bibliography, it is mammoth. It'd take years to go through that kind of material. And he certainly acknowledges that he benefited from a couple of full-time researchers when he was writing the book. There's so many things that are covered in this book that I can't possibly attempt to sort of summarize them, but I'll try to touch on a couple of them. One is the Panama Canal, the Panama Canal Treaty. And, you know, he points out that 78% of the public opposed that treaty, opposed any involvement to try to give it back to Panama. And he does point out that Baker, Church, and some others basically formed a moderate coalition to pass this legislation, essentially ratify the treaty so that it would come into force. And he asserts that there were many members at the time that knew that it wasn't going to help them. It was actually going to hurt their reelection chances. And we'll talk about this theme later, but I mean, he refers to the last great Senate as many of these senators who sacrificed to basically do the nation's work. And I think, as I'll talk about later, there's a bit of a lament that kind of ethic is gone. There's also a very interesting portrayal of the SALT II treaties. And there again, it's interesting, I think, from my perspective, just because it's a very good chapter that sort of shows how one senator can sort of be a spoiler. And it's not an issue of filibuster and preventing necessarily a vote on the treaty itself, but it's a case where Scoop Jackson, the senator, ex-senator from Washington State, deceased, was an expert on arms control. He had been for years. He was probably the recognized expert in Washington, D.C. on arms control. And he was self-recognized as an expert as well. He had a huge ego. And you see how this dynamic is set up between Carter and Jackson, one where Jackson in many ways is envious of Carter because Carter just wiped him out in the primaries. He had to withdraw right away. So I think Jackson is envious of the fact that Carter is president, but he's also envious of the fact that Carter does not bother to talk to him ahead of time. He basically brings back a treaty, takes it up to the Senate and says, okay, I want this ratified. And in some ways, this book is painful to read because you can see Carter just making mistake after mistake after mistake. And I'm looking back in time and thinking, oh, please don't do that. But he does. Just to sort of give you an indication of what kind of power the Senate and the House have with respect to international treaties, all international treaties must be ratified by the Senate. So they don't get anywhere unless the Senate ratifies it. Beyond that, there's a number of ways either side, either the House or the Senate, affects treaties. In addition to ratification, there has to be an authorization for the program itself. So if there's some sort of governmental apparatus, there needs to be an authorization for that to take place. We authorize NOAA to engage in the Antarctic Treaty, and we appropriate so much money. So first part is ratification, authorization. Then there's the actual appropriation of money to effect the treaty and the authorization of appropriation. So there's a million ways that Congress can interfere with a treaty if it chooses to do so. So, it's rather perplexing why in a number of instances Carter did not consult with the Senate ahead of time. The energy crisis legislation. I have to say that, the book reminded me of just how prescient Jimmy Carter was on the issue of energy. I mean, one of the very first things he does is try to get the Senate and the House to address really comprehensive energy legislation. His goal was to try to conserve energy. He recognized that we were dependent on oil imports, but nothing doing. The book is a little bit frustrating in the sense that you read that there's this machinations, bills go back and forth, they finally adopt one bill on the House side, one's on the Senate side, but they can't agree in a conference committee. It keeps going over to the next Congress. And unfortunately for Carter, that energy crisis that he sort of walked into, the aftermath of the OPEC issue, just goes to hell in a handbasket with the revolution in Iran. And the book does a very good job of sort of going over those events. I should ask too, how many of you actually read the book? And don't be bashful if you haven't done it, because it'll change kind of what I say. So really, everyone here other than a couple people? Okay, who's read it? Okay. All right, so that helps me. Don't be embarrassed at all. I do recommend that if you have any interest in history, read the book. I mean, it's a little bit of a slog, and I say that because at times it's a little disjointed. He talks about one thing and then he'll jump back in time and start talking about what was going on in 1962 or 1964. But I think he does it for a reason. And it's part of it is really important to the overall story. He spends a fair amount of time talking about LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, when he was Senate Majority Leader. And, LBJ is famous for saying, don't get mad, get even. And the kind of Senate that he ran was, he was a martinet. I mean, he demanded discipline. And so they're really, basically the rest of the players had to march to his tune. And if they didn't do it, they paid for it. But at the end of his service, when he points out that when Mike Mansfield took over, he was democratic in how he, quote-unquote, ran the Senate. In fact, in many respects, he didn't run it. It just sort of operated by inertia, and there was much less discipline. Shapiro talks about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and the escalation of the Vietnam War, and he does so because I think it sets the stage for what is happening during the Carter years. The Senate had adopted the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and I don't know how many people kind of remember what happened. I was, you know, just at the point where, you know, I was probably cognizant of what was going on, but in many ways kind of a trumped up issue in which the Senate succumbed and gave basically LBJ carte blanche power to engage in war acts in Vietnam, but short of an actual war resolution. And I think he points out that many senators over time grew to regret this granting such powers to a president in office. So from there, he begins to talk about the Nixon landslide in his reelection, Watergate, the Watergate hearings, the resignation of Nixon, and essentially he's telling us these things in part because I think he's showing us, look, there's a vacuum between Capitol Hill and the presidency. And really I think what he's saying is, you know, the Senate is, all these things have happened, and the Senate realizes that it has a lot of power and it has a lot of muscle, and they're ready to flex that muscle. They're ready to restrain what has appeared to have been an imperial presidency. And one thing I should tell you is, I clearly have my own biases here. So, you know, I worked for a Democratic House. I worked for a House committee that was controlled by Democrats. So my view is going to be colored by that. And many of you may have a different view of, you know, past events or the spin that's on the ball. So bear with me. I just want you to know what my biases are. So anyway, I think that's why he sets up that dynamic and starts talking about things in the past and how it affected those years that Carter was in office. But I think the part that is painful in this book is just the degree to which Carter failed to understand, appreciate, or view Congress as a partner. Just a critical mistake on Carter's part. In part because I think he was a Washington outsider, a true outsider, and that can cut either way. And in some respects, I think maybe it helped Carter during the election process, but it certainly didn't serve him well the rest of the time. So that's why I say that the book is painful to read in some respects. There is no question that Carter is an intelligent man, moral, kind, patient, but in many ways, with respect to politics, the politics of the White House and the Senate, guy's out to lunch. He was insensitive and incredibly naive. And the book points out that the very first meeting that he has with these senators, he calls them to the White House to tell them what his legislative agenda is. Now, you would think that maybe before he got to that point, he'd want to go talk to some of the key senators and say, hey, this is what I'm thinking about doing. Do you think it could pass? You know, what are the merits and demerits? So there's some sort of, you know, building of a common program, but no. So he calls them in, and they're 3 hours on these cold folding metal chairs with no potty break. And there's something you should know about senators, and that is they kind of think they're more important than that. You know, it's probably not a good way to start. So he, at the same meeting, he announces he's going to kill a bunch of major public works projects important to Western senators and Russell Long. And these very senators whose projects they've worked to appropriate money for and have constituents that want, well, he tells them he's going to kill the program. But I don't think what he thought about is, you know, days later he's going to have to go back and ask for their support, you know, to implement his legislative agenda. So I suppose, you know, I'm almost getting frustrated kind of talking about it. So they're even in his own party, and you went, why did he do that? So as I mentioned, SALT II failed to meet with Scoop Jackson to discuss the arms control issue with him. The book points out that, you know, at one point that, you know, China basically says, well, if you want to normalize relations with us, here's what you have to do. You have to, you know, withdraw troops from Taiwan. You have to sever diplomatic relations with Taiwan. And you have to abrogate a mutual defense treaty. And Carter eventually agrees to it, all without any consultation with key senators in up on the Hill. And, you know, if he had done so, they probably would have warned him, hey, you know, you're treading on thin ice here. You really need to be careful. But he didn't do it. Not so much that the Senate would deny him ratification if it was required, but they probably could have kept him out of trouble. And as a consequence, you know, Reagan and a number of people basically take his action on Taiwan and recognition or full diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China, and it hurts him badly during re-election, along with a number of other things. So, you know, Shapiro lays blame on Carter for being naive and insensitive, and I agree with all that, but here's something that I think Shapiro misses, and I don't recall seeing this in one single place. Where was the man who asked, where's the beef? Do you guys remember this? I mean, he was the guy that, where's Mondale? I mean, Mondale was a senator for how many years? He's president pro tem of the Senate. He's the vice president whose advice is so valued that Carter has him in an office next to his. I'm absolutely baffled. I hadn't really thought about it until, you know, I started scratching my head as I read the book and said, where was Mondale? It seems like, having been a senator, he would have advised Carter, you know, you have to consult with the Senate. Simple as that. Don't get started until you've done so. But anyway, that's history. I want to talk a little bit about the energy battles recounted in the book. And as I said, you know, I think Carter was very prescient in going to Congress right away and saying, hey, we need to do something on energy. And he tried, and for probably failure to consult, didn't come up with the program that was adopted in his first 2 years in office. But with the Iranian Revolution, basically the spigot was turned off. And gas prices rose by 25%. I think 58% of the gas stations were shut down. And it's funny, I remember at the time, and I don't know if you guys have a similar recollection, but I do remember that the gas prices were very high, but I did some quick research and I found out that the inflation adjusted price right now is $3.49 a gallon. And somehow it doesn't sound too bad right now. But I think at the time it was absolutely shocking. And we were totally unprepared for it, mentally or economically. And, you know, it just seems like Carter is just on this terrible bad luck roll. I mean, the Iran crisis happens, the spigot's turned off, Three of Mile Island happens, so nuclear energy is off the table. So he goes back to Congress again and basically gives them this really watered-down energy program and finally manages to get something to work. But in the process, he's just attacked by all sides. There's a great passage in the book about Ted Kennedy just starting to in public speeches go after Carter in the worst of ways. And there's really a kind of an interesting passage on page 245 to 246 where it got so bad that somebody told Tip O'Neill, you have to go talk to Ted Kennedy. You're from Massachusetts. You need to calm him down. So Tip goes and talks to him and says, hey, you know, you need to lay off the president. What are you going to do? Are you going to run? And he says, oh, no, I'm not going to run. I'm going to support the president. And, of course, Tip says, well, gosh, you know, you sure have a funny way of showing that. And really, I think the passage shows that Kennedy comes back and says, well, yeah, I'm kind of enjoying what I'm doing. And, you know, I think that maybe shows some of the flaws in senators. There's this envy. They're at one end of Capitol Hill, but they want to be down in the White House. And so there's a lot of envy built up and kind of a strange dynamic that can get developed between certain senators. And I think that dynamic did get set up by a number of the senators that Shapiro talks about. Scoop Jackson, for one, Ted Kennedy, Church, even. A number of them had aspirations to run for president, but it was Carter's outsider status that really made him be president, plus the fact that he really knew how the rules worked in the primary process, and he took full advantage of that. I'm not going to kind of get into some of the details of that. So anyway, everyone's picking on Carter, and not just in a niggling sort of way. I mean, he's being picked right down to the bone. And finally, he's scheduled to come back from a trip to Tokyo, and he has a big press conference scheduled. And 2 days prior to this press conference, he abruptly cancels it. In part because his staff is starting to tell him that there's really something going on with the American public. There's this crisis in confidence that is taking place, and it's really serious. And I really do think that, I mean, Shapiro doesn't talk about this much in the book, but you know, when you start to read about Carter and the schedule that he had to put up with, I think he was just plain old exhausted. You know, here he comes back from Tokyo and immediately has the press conference scheduled, or he comes back from the USSR after negotiating the SALT Treaty, and within 2 hours he's on national television. I don't know how anybody could sustain that sort of thing. Plus, people are just going after him. And so he gives this crisis in confidence speech. Some people call it the malaise speech, and it's really not covered very much in the book, but I did go online, and indeed it is available online, and I actually want to play part of it for you, or parts, and we'll see how this works.
Good evening. This is a special night for me. Exactly 3 years ago, on July 15th, 1976, I accepted the nomination of my party to run for President of the United States. I promised you a president who is not isolated from the people, who feels your pain and who shares your dreams, and who draws his strength and his wisdom from you. During the past 3 years, I've spoken to you on many occasions about national concerns, the energy crisis, reorganizing the government, our nation's economy, and issues of war, and especially peace. But over those years, the subjects of the speeches, the talks, and the press conferences have become increasingly narrow, focused more and more on what the isolated world of Washington thinks is important. Gradually, you've heard more and more about what the government thinks, or what the government should be doing, and less about our nation's hopes, our dreams, and our vision of the future. 10 days ago, I had planned to speak to you again about a very important subject.
So he's just come back from Camp David.
I would have described the urgency of the problem and laid out a series of legislative recommendations to the Congress. But as I was preparing to speak, I began to ask myself the same question that I now know has been troubling many of you. Why have we not been able to get together as a nation to resolve our serious energy problem? It's clear that the true problems of our nation are much deeper, deeper than gasoline lines or energy shortages, deeper even than inflation or recession. So I want to speak to you first tonight about a subject even more serious than energy or inflation. I want to talk to you right now about a fundamental threat to American democracy. I do not mean our political and civil liberties.
I'm going to jump ahead for a little bit. So anyway, he's getting to the point that really there's, I think he's identifying that there's a moral struggle that's taking place.
You see a Congress twisted and pulled in every direction by hundreds of well-financed and powerful special interests. You see every extreme position defended to the last vote, almost to the last breath, by one unyielding group or another. You often see a balanced and a fair approach that demands sacrifice, a little sacrifice from everyone, abandoned like an orphan, without support and without friends. Often you see paralysis and stagnation and drift. You don't like it, and neither do I. What can we do? First of all, we must face the truth, and then we can change our course. We simply must have faith in each other, faith in our ability to govern ourselves, and faith in the future of this nation. Restoring that faith and that confidence to America is now the most important task we face. It is a...
There's a couple of other passages that I'd love to play for you, but I can see I'm starting to run out of time, and I need to get to some other things. But, you know, essentially the speech that he gave was very unusual for a presidential speech. I mean, talking about issues of morality, the soul, spirituality, and it was very, very unusual for the time. According to Shapiro, it was pretty well received by the public. I mean, I think they recognized that Congress was not working as it should, and the initial reviews were very good. However, he's then attacked by pundits, by, you know, the other party, and his poll numbers start to decline pretty significantly. He then accepts five cabinet-level resignations. So he has a huge changeover in his cabinet. And in fact, it got so bad that Howard Baker came to his defense, a Republican, and John Danforth came to his defense. So Carter is absolutely besieged in this period, and he had to have been just a forlorn and lonely individual. I'm sure that he was grateful to have his religion that he could fall back to, that gave him some succor. The other theme that I think is pretty interesting throughout the book is, and I call it with friends like these, you know, just looking at the SALT II treaty and the attempt to get it ratified. I mean, Scoop Jackson was vicious. He clearly, you know, did not trust the Soviet Union and thought that it was a mistake to try to come to treaty terms over nuclear arms with the Soviet Union. But once they came to loggerheads, I mean, Scoop went so far as to call Carter an appeaser in the same sense that that Neville Chamberlain was an appeaser to Hitler. The dynamics just, you can see in the book, just go from bad to worse. And I end up, as I read the book, I end up feeling more and more sorry for Carter just just how bad things are developing. In order to try to, you kind of see this dynamic developing too, where in order to try to get the treaty ratified, he starts giving things away to people to try to bring them on board so he can get his 60 votes for ratification. The problem is, as he puts things on his boat to try to get the treaty to float, it just overwhelms that boat. Basically, what he finds is that if he agrees to Sam Nunn's request for a 5% increase in defense spending and the MX missile, that basically he loses other parts of his coalition of supporting the treaty. And in the end, the whole thing falls apart. So it just didn't work for him. Finally, the USSR invades Afghanistan in 79, and that does it. The end of the arms treaty. So, you know, there's many other fascinating legislative battles, not the least of which is the Panama Canal, and I could probably talk to you for an hour about the Panama Canal itself, because the committee I worked for actually had a subcommittee on the Panama Canal, so there were people really devoted to the functioning of the Panama Canal. So let's kind of summarize some thoughts about the book. You know, two conflicting views. You know, kind of Shapiro's view, it was the golden era versus poison politics that we have now. And he has this quote in here, this was how the great Senate worked in the era when it was still great. Issues were taken on the merits and faced no matter how tough they were. Nominees got judged on their merits irrespective of partisan politics. The national interest dictated the result. It was the last great Senate and it would not last much longer. Basically, you know, I suppose he's saying, you know, senators were braver in some respects. They were willing to take risks, do the nation's business, even if they thought it could affect their election chances. One thing Shapiro touches on, but I don't think he touches on enough, is the fact that during this era, most of those senators went through the Depression. They went through World War II. And they had a lot of common experience, a lot of shared hardship. And I think that both the public and the senators in that period felt like the government could do good. I mean, it was an instrument of good. You think about Robert Byrd, where he grew up, TVA program, rural electrification. There were so many things that the government did that were respected. But I guess the ultimate question is, were these senators braver? He recounts the Panama Canal, the bailout of New York City, Chrysler, this coalition that came together. And in some respects, you have Republicans, you know, supporting the president's program that later became very unpopular. He even states that Baker knew it would affect his presidential aspirations to support some of these programs, like the New York City bailout, the Chrysler bailout, and the Panama Canal. One thing he does really emphasize is just how much the Senate has changed. The epilogue, if you read nothing else, read one chapter in the book and then read the epilogue. And I think he basically says, you know, the whole institution has changed. The respect for fellow senators, the respect for the norms of behavior, the feeling of community is gone. And I can tell you, I could see that changing when I worked on Capitol Hill. Newt Gingrich had just come on board, and there was a completely different approach, and it was a much more personal approach. And it used to be a body where it was pretty rare to have somebody actually say a nasty word or call somebody a name. And those times are changed. Shapiro recounts this Congressional Quarterly article where there's a picture of Mansfield, Jack Kennedy, and Scoop Jackson playing softball together. And basically the article goes on to lament, gosh, those days are gone. And I can say that when I worked on Capitol Hill, that's how things happened. We socialized together, we played softball together, we were friends, we could disagree, but it was much easier to, I think, work out compromises or simply agree to disagree. So let's look at view two, kind of a different view. Well, is it really a lament? maybe Shapiro just doesn't fully recognize the culture war that we're in. Rich versus poor, religious versus secular, pro-life versus pro-choice. And he's just on the losing side right now. The Democrats lack the votes and the power that they had in 76 to 1980 or prior times. They can't dictate the legislative agenda anymore. They can't count on moderate Republicans. They're virtually extinct. There's much more polarization, huge chasm in the middle right now. And so maybe it's just a lament over the fact that the Democrats can't dictate the legislative agenda. I'm not telling you this because I believe it, but I mean, those are, you know, kind of alternating views of kind of what Shapiro is faced with. And indeed, if you read some of the reviews in the major newspapers, you will see that there is kind of even a polarized review of Shapiro's book on both sides. But I do think he's largely accurate. As I said, you know, when I worked on Capitol Hill, we played softball together, we socialized together. It was really, even at the committee level, the chairman played poker with, you know, people in the minority. It was much more social. And I was telling my son, he said I should definitely talk about this. I worked on this what I consider a big piece of legislation for us, and it was an excise tax for sport fishing programs. And it was actually an excise tax that the industry supported. And that would never be considered today. Why? Because people have drawn lines in the sand and said, you know, no taxes whatsoever. So I don't think we'd even get to the point where that would take place. But I will tell you that at one point we did reach a big impasse. And Howard Baker and his staff called like six people that were working on this piece of legislation into his then majority leader office. And when you go into this office, I mean, you think about the history that's there. I mean, there have been a lot of people do a lot of things in that office, and really ornate wood and marble floors. And so Howard Baker and his staff, we sit at a table, and pretty soon some tumblers come out, and ice, and some really old Jack Daniel's whiskey, and everyone sits at the table and, you know, has a drink of whiskey, and we all talk about, all right, well, what's it going to take to get this piece of legislation passed? What are the key issues, and can we overcome them? And of course we can. And I think in part because there's a couple of reasons. One is because there's a much bigger middle. It's not so polarized. And the other reason is we're all friends. We all know one another. And we all realize that, you know, kind of given what we have, there is a greater interest to get something done. So Jonathan, my son, who happens to be here, can ask me a question or make a point that on the way here this morning, he had a pretty astute observation kind of about how culture has changed, but I'll leave that to him. But a lot has changed on Capitol Hill, and not for the better. I think I'm probably out of time. So why don't we, I mean, I could talk about many other things. The only other thing I think I really want to emphasize and haven't talked about is just how money has changed, and the continuous need to raise money, and the continuous campaigning that has gone on. And there's been a couple of Supreme Court decisions that have not helped, and they're listed here, and we can talk about them later. I'll be here for as long as anyone wants to talk, and I'm open to questions.
So first, will there ever be another great Senate?
It's going to be a long, long time. I think we sort of talked about this, the fact that, you know, there's a culture war that is kind of has gone on for quite some time. And I think it plays out in rich v. poor, pro-life v. Pro-choice, you know, the tax structure, unions versus business. There's a whole gamut of things that I think has eliminated people like Richard Lugar, who's featured prominently in this book, just got defeated in his primary race this year. Olympia Snow just said she's resigning. She's not going to run again. We have lost that huge group of people in the middle. So there may be a great Senate, but not for a long, long time.
John, when you mentioned one of the things that I think that happened for Obama was the degree of corruption, and then all of a sudden the obvious misstatements about what was true and what was false. People just outright lying and keep on lying. And I just recently saw a film by Frank Capra, who in 1942 was trying to rev up the troops because we were an isolationist country. No one wanted to go to war. And so he talked about the people who were behind the Japanese, the Italians, and the Germans. And it seems like more and more there's less regard for the truth than ever before. The degree of corruption, such as was presented in the Frank Capra film, about three cultures were there, and it frightens me. What do you think?
Well, I have to admit that I don't watch television. And so I have not seen the debates. You know, it's kind of funny that when I left Capitol Hill, I think I had tremors. I had withdrawal symptoms. And it was a long time before I could kind of get used to not being involved in those kinds of things. But to answer your question, I think people, for some reason, have gotten a lot bolder at departing from the truth. Why? I don't know. I don't know if it's because they're not called on the carpet, or, you know, there's just not an opportunity to do that given the pace of elections, or, you know, given the pace of government. In terms of corruption, you know, I mean, at one point in my notes, I actually had made a list of the number of congressmen or senators that I knew had spent time in prison or had been shamefully chased out of office. And it was a big list. There's lots of opportunity for that. I knew some awfully good people that I worked with, senators and congressmen, that I don't think they would ever think about doing it, but I'm sure there is corruption. I don't know if it's any more evident today than it was 10 years ago or not. Can't say. I don't know if I've answered your question, Hiram, but.
No, that's what I was asking for.
Anyone else? Yeah.
From an amateur point of view, it looks like the Senate is a more diverse group of people than it was when these senators were primarily white, older men. And yet you mentioned that what held them together was a common experience. And it seems, without having the pleasure of reading the book, that that's one of the bigger issues we face right now, is we lack a common experience for red and blue, or all these various situations. In fact, 11 states are probably going to decide who's going to be the next president of the United States. That seems like a pretty important issue that lends itself to division right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think your comment about the Senate is a different place than it was, in large part because we have a lot of women serving in the Senate now. I think when I worked on Capitol Hill, I think there may have been one U.S. senator that was a woman, Nancy Kassenbaum, if I remember right. And now I think there's 16, led by Barbara Mikulski, I think, is the longest serving U.S. Senator. Our state of Washington has two women serving in the Senate. I think Maine has two. New York has one. Yeah, there are a lot more women in the Senate. Jonathan actually had pointed out that, you know, it kind of has gone from kind of the men's club to something different. And, you know, he has an interesting perspective about societal norms and the fact that maybe that's all tied up in this big conflict that we seem to be having. But I mean, your point in general about how the Senate has changed and the fact that there is no longer this kind of big overarching commonality, this thing that the nation has gone through together. That is the case. And I think maybe it's one of those kinds of things that will eventually lead to another kind of center again, instead of, you know, it seems like we had a bell curve and there was a lot of people in the center, and now it's like, it's kind of this weird distribution where, you know, the ends are pretty heavy.
Gretchen, Shirley.
I'm harking back to another comment, and that was about facts. And there was an article in one of the three papers this morning, and it was about the ads on television and how no one is doing much about the facts, certainly not the people that take the money and run the ads. So that is a problem, along with the polarization, is that it pays off to lie on either side.
Yeah, I think.
Sadly.
Yeah, I think it can pay off, at least in the short run. I mean, it didn't pay off for Richard Nixon in the long run. It didn't pay off for Bill Clinton in the long run. I mean, there are, you know, you can think of instances where, you know, where the truth was not told and eventually it caught up with people. But I think the election cycle in particular is a different critter, and things happen so fast, and there is no watchdog out there that somehow is, you know, pressing the button and telling people false, wrong. we don't have that. So yeah, I think we suffer from it. And beyond that, I think part of the problem is, I hate to sound elitist, but I think that there, the number of people that simply don't know what's going on, don't read a newspaper, is big. It's too big. And in order to function well in a democracy, we have to have a better educated electorate. And that's where a lot of you guys come in here in Corvallis. Hopefully educators. I'm sure there's a lot of educators in this crowd. Yeah.
I wonder what we can do to shift the priorities back to education in this country, because they've certainly shifted away from it.
I don't know. That's a tough one. I mean, you know, Tip O'Neill always said all politics are local. I mean, you know, it starts at the local level and it goes up from there. I mean, you just have to try to, I don't know how involved, you know, you guys are in the election process. Our kids were involved in the election process when they were quite young, and we've continued to remain involved, especially at the local level. It's a civic duty. I mean, if there's enough people, then it'll change. If there's not, and we're asleep at the wheel, I think things will depart from there.
From your experience in reading the book, the apparent gridlock that exists, is it more due to people, to individuals, or to the system?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily the system. I mean, the system worked in the past. I mean, democracy's not a pretty process. You know, if you were designing a way of, you know, governing large numbers of people in a good way, I'm not sure democracy would be the best way to do it. I'm not advocating something else. It's probably the best we have, but it's really kind of an ugly process. I don't think it's the system. I do think it's the people in a couple of respects. One is kind of this culture war that is going on, and the fact that we, you know, we get people that are so polarized that I don't think they can even begin to do the kind of bonding, the sort of communitarian approach that we have or had in the past, so that, you know, you're friends. I don't think those people are friends at all, and I think they're so polarized that I don't think they can be friends. And when you have, for example, Mitch McConnell, you know, making a statement like, you know, our number one priority is to make sure that, you know, President Obama is a one-term president. I can't remember exactly what the quote, I'm paraphrasing. I mean, I think it's fine for him to think that. But to say that, I think that's the start on this hill. And I'm not necessarily trying to single out, you know, Republicans for that sort of thing. But I think that's part of the problem. And one of the things that Ira Shapiro points out in his book is, you know, the Senate is this body that's had this long practice of norms. And, you know, it was a very collegial place. There were certain ways that they interacted with one another that was pretty distinguished. You know, it was it pretty high-minded. And he points out that, you know, Bill Frist, when he was in the leadership in the Senate, actually went to Daschle's district and campaigned against Daschle when he was in the leadership. And normally the rule is no senator would ever go to another senator's district and campaign against them. Why? Well, it's not a very good way of developing a friendship, for one. And in this case, I mean, I think Bill Frist sort of, you know, rolled the dice and he won. I mean, he won that battle, but in the long run, I think there's such damage with that kind of behavior. I don't think he should have done it.
Last question, I think.
Okay.
Well, this may lead to some more discussion, because I want to make a intervention in what I perceive to be the trajectory of the discussion. I feel like Ira Shapiro has a pretty naive idea, and I'm hearing this echoed in the direction of this discussion, that the culture war is somehow an ephemeral thing, that if only we could return to the good old days where we all would just sit down and rationally agree about what to do. I don't think that it considers that the culture war may be something that we have to actually go through, not just avoid. There may be structural reasons why this is happening. And I think that we've seen the Democratic Party shift to the right, because they want to go back to this time of comedy instead of playing hardball politics, when maybe that's what they should be focusing on. The story about the tumblers, for example, post-sexual revolution, post-Title IX and all this stuff, I don't see how you can go back to consensus politics where you're all guys sharing the same ideas about yourself. There may be a reason that there's this divide today. And yeah. What's your comment?
I think it's a good point. The prospect, I guess, of going through a long cultural war is not a very endearing idea. The thought that we're going to be doing this for a long time doesn't feel very good. but you may very well be right. We may be doing this for a long time.
I mean, the liberal consensus isn't something that's existed forever. It was something that was built out of calamity of Great Depression.
And World
and
War
II. The country's been more divided than it is now. Look at the Civil War. And you couldn't just wish away the very real divide that existed over slavery. You had to go through some real struggle before you could come back together as a country. So I just find Shapiro a little bit naive, I guess.
I think those are good points.
I think we we should wrap things up.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm around if anyone has questions, comments, whatever.